Thank you for including me in your
podcast.
This project that you're doing, I appreciate it.
Well, I'm happy to have artists like yourself here, artists that I wasn't familiar with in the past that we've started recording. Mm-hmm. And this wonderful garden you have in New York City to sit and conduct the interview is, I think, a good starting point since ecology, indigenous societies, I guess shamanism is part of your work. The first question I had to do with how you started, because I think it's quite fascinating that the curator mentioned in some ways your work falls into the outsider art category.
Yes.
So tell us how you started out as an artist.
Well, I started out quite young and kind of just following impulses to draw and to make marks and images and pictograms of different things. And I don't have any self-concept that it was making art or that it had any kind of meaning or importance other than to myself. But probably by the time I was a young teenager, probably 12, 13 years old, I understood and recognized that what I was doing was making art, and that it was meant as some kind of marker, communication device, ability to express and put myself in the world in some way. And so I've identified as an artist and an art maker for all of my life.
And I remember yesterday you said that the first time you realized you were doing art, your dad wasn't so supportive, so for many years you did art in secret.
Yeah, so coming from a family where art making was not something that was seen as being a kind of a very positive career choice of any kind, nor did in his family did they want children doing silly and stupid and meaningless things. And plus my drawings disturbed him, and so my imagery and the things that were coming out of me were disturbing to him. And so after getting corroboration from the institutional people that his son was free of any artistic talent whatsoever,
yes.
I was forbidden to make art in the home, and then I began this kind of career path of a secret artist, making art in secret. And of course to be caught or was to be punished, and the punishments were severe. So it was, for me as a young kid, it was quite a serious thing to conduct this art making in secret. But the consequences of being discovered were incredibly worrisome. And so I took to making art in secret quite seriously.
And tell me a little bit about your ethnicity, because you mentioned yesterday that somehow you fall into some felt sought is from where?
From Russia.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people of my ethnicity, Semitic people, they are nomadic. And, you know, we traveled from country to country throughout Eastern Europe and never quite were accepted in any of the countries where we settled. And so people kind of kept to themselves and kind of created their own kind of bubble of a community inside a larger cultural context.
Right.
And that continued when my family came to the United States before I was born. They maintained that kind of ethnic bubble, insulated. And so when I was a child growing up, everybody spoke Yiddish, Hebrew, and everything was self-reference. You didn't deal with outsiders, you mm-hmm. didn't participate with any outsiders. And so it was a very kind of closed loop of a community. And that kind of thing, it doesn't so much exist on the West Coast where I live, but certainly on the East Coast and in some of these more urban American cities, you still find this kind of thing.
And then how, because now I understand what your background is, how did you end up becoming part of these indigenous societies in Central and South America?
Well, that's kind of a, you know, a funny story.
Because if you ask me, I think you look like you could be part of those.
Well, I'll tell you something that's really funny. Mm-hmm. Because I'm small, certainly for an American.
Yeah.
Of stature.
Mm-hmm.
So the indigenous people down in the Amazon are also very small people. So they're used to being differentiated by their size, right? Because when they go into urban places, even in Latin America, they tend to be these tiny people. And they're kind of identified,
yeah,
right? Partly by their size.
Mm-hmm.
And so they always had this thing of Americans were these large people. And so they couldn't quite understand that I was an American because I was small like they were.
Right.
And so they would say to me things like, oh, you know, you must have indigenous blood in you because you can't be an American because look at your size. And I'd say, no, I'm an American. And
yes.
They'd say, no, it's just that your parents were embarrassed to tell you that you came from indigenous people.
Right. That's funny, right? Actually.
And so as I got older, of course, my understanding of indigenous people has evolved. And I now understand that all of us, everybody, no matter where you come from, no matter the color of your skin, no matter where you're, you know, five generations of ancestors that you can trace came from. All of us, of course, trace our ancestry back to the original people.
Yeah,
all of us.
Yeah, yeah.
And so all of us have, all of us started out as indigenous people. All of us can trace our DNA back to the original hunter-gatherer tribes that roamed across this planet in so many different ways.
Mm-hmm.
And so all of us are connected in that way, and so, you know, looking at plant communities, human communities, it depends where you choose to take the snapshot.
Right.
And that people use that as some kind of defining thing of an invasive species or an indigenous species or whatever, but if you understand the creation unfolding, it is this constant evolutionary trend towards all kinds of things traveling and mixing and evolving and setting up homes in different places and different lands and whatever. And all of us have that history. All of us kind of, in a way, plants, animals, humans, all of us nomadic.
Yeah, yeah.
So back to your original question. I didn't mean to diverse, but...
No, but I think it's good to diverse, you know, because you just reminded me of something and I hadn't figured out the solution to this problem. But if we continue to be nomadic like indigenous people are, the idea of scarcity really doesn't exist. Because if you think there's famine somewhere, people would move in the past to somewhere that's more abundant.
Yes.
They wouldn't just stay in the famine area, which I guess we somehow manage now because we have all this stuff that we're attached to. So that's a really interesting point, I think.
Well, and you know, it also asks a deeper question, which is, you know, I've certainly, because of my situation and who I am, many, many people have asked me about shamanism and shamanic traditions, and there's a lot of curiosity and interest in that, especially now. And I find as I talk to people that they don't really understand what the shamanic traditions were about. And the shamanic traditions were practiced by all hunter-gatherer people all over the world, and they had different rituals and ceremonies and technologies, but there were also an extraordinary amount of commonality in those traditions. Even though these people weren't in communication with each other or sharing these things, it's like they kind of all went to the well together. They were drawing water from the same well. And what is common in the shamanic traditions is this, they don't divide the natural world into animate and inanimate. for them, all of creation is animate. All of creation is alive. And so a rock, a mountain, a plant, a river, a lake, an animal, a human, mm-hmm, a bird, mm-hmm, the sky, the wind, all of it is alive. And shamanism asks a practitioner to recognize the aliveness of all things, and that all things have a voice, all things have a power, all things have a wisdom. And shamanism is, it's not about magic or hocus pocus or airy fairy new age beliefs. It's simple. It's about understanding that aliveness in all things and aligning oneself to those energetics, to aligning oneself to the natural world, to the wind, to the rains, to the mountain, to the rocks, and this is why shamanic objects are imbued with life, because if all things are alive, then the rock or the feather or the stick also is alive. And so when everything is alive, when everything has a voice, when somebody is living in respect to that and allowing for the natural dignity of that to arise, then of course you can travel anywhere in the world and move and behave in a way that is respectful. And this is why amongst the traditional people, even though they were nomadic, even though they changed hunting grounds or places where they gathered, of course following the bounty of the world, whenever they arrived someplace, they understood that it was alive. They understood that you asked permission. They understood that you behave respectfully, that you treat things well, that you take only what you need and no more, that you share, that you... And so that's why those cultures represent a certain kind of model to us. And when people started dividing the world into the animate and the inanimate, mm-hmm, and things were just things, then it allowed people to begin to behave in a way that was disrespectful, because if it's just a thing, then what do I care? And I don't have to ask its permission, and I don't have to behave a certain way, and I don't have to conduct myself in a certain way. It's just a thing, and it's just, I just use it, and then I discard it. And so you can begin to see that as we kind of moved away from these shamanic traditions, we also kind of planted a seed of destruction and disrespect into our relationship to the world and the resources and whatever. And that's why now when you have the thought of refugees and people moving about, it's scary. Because people are like, well, this is mine, and this is my place, and I have to defend it, and the people who arrive, they're not going to respect my things, and whatever, and so you develop a conflict, an animosity, of which, you know, when I arrived in the Amazon a long, long time ago, I was a stranger. And of course, I was in a place where back then, strangers never went. You know, this was not... This is long before the days of tourism or cultural or shamanic tourism, mm-hmm, was taking place. And it was quite dangerous. And yet I arrived with a feeling of peace and respect. And I didn't understand the people and, mm-hmm, and their culture, but they sensed in me some kind of just respectful understanding and demeanor, mm-hmm, and so I was treated with extraordinary kindness. And so these were people that every day they have to gather food to eat, and they would always make sure that I had plenty. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And so I was struck by here I was, a stranger from a strange land, so to speak, and treated with extraordinary kindness and hospitality.
Yes.
And it was really for that, you know, that became one of the foundational pieces of my work going forward, was to understand if people could treat me like that, it was my responsibility to pay that forward and to treat others in that way.
Yes, going back to what you mentioned yesterday about you becoming the medicine that you seek. So I'm going to take it back to the art now, because can you describe the trajectory of your work from the first objects you made in secret until now? I mean, like work like Burning Monk 2013 and Untitled with Unfortunate Incident 2022, that's some of the most recent work that has to do with the conflict between people, wars.
Yes.
So how does that tie into the first things you did as a child and growing up and in secret? How did it evolve?
Well, again, when I was young, and even as a young man, and showing my work in the art world and whatever, I wouldn't have used a lot of the terminology or descriptors that I would use now. Of course, this is all hindsight, you know, and coming from an old guy, you know, who's had a long time to look back over my life and my trajectory, right? Mm-hmm. But back then, I was kind of involved in making art, and I was aware that there was some kind of energetic that I was kind of working with and trying to find some kind of relationship or connection to. And the energetics were quite powerful and quite strong, and so my work was very shamanic in its attempt to try to find some kind of equilibrium in a very, very powerful field. And of course there were very powerful things moving within myself, but also, you know, I'm a child of the 60s, and so I grew up in a time when the world also was aflame. It was quite charged, and the Vietnam War was raging, and you know, tens of thousands of people from my generation were killed in that war, and many of us were quite militant in resisting that war. And of course there was the draft, and people went to all kinds of extraordinary things to resist the draft and all of this. And so I'm making art and trying to deal with these internal energetics that are just in me, and in my own kind of lineage or genetics or whatever. And and I'm also in a world that's extremely volatile and in conflict, and people are massive demonstrations, and you know, not dissimilar to the time that we just went through with the Black Lives Matter and all of this kind of trying to puncture that wound of racism and social injustice and social inequities. And so my art was kind of standing in between those kinds of energetics. And I also was feeling something, like there was something ancient, some kind of primordial energy that was felt very important, and that I also was organically connected to. And that primordialness has been a through line in my work for 50 years now. And so sometimes people miscategorize my work, and they will say, oh, it's similar to primitive art, or they'll try to look at some kind of traditional art and draw some kind of correlations. And they're missing the point. The work is not primitive, it is connected to the primordial. And inside the primordial is the whole thing, is creation unfolding. It's light and dark, it's the rapture and the magic and the wonders and the mysteries and the beauty, and there's the plagues and the wars and the famines and the tragedies and whatever, and all of it is kind of bubbling out of this this vast kind of this container that is the primordial world. And always as an artist, it seems like I'm trying to connect into the primordial, and even current events I'm trying to see and understand it as a murmuring of the primordial world, and to kind of help people link those things together.
Yes, yes. The next question I had, I'm going to read it because I really can't remember what I wrote earlier in terms of question. It's kind of related to the last question, but could you speak about the role of the artist and shaman in society as witness bearer and healer? Because you spoke a little bit about that in terms of, like, again, the burning monk from the Vietnam mm-hmm. War. And you said your work is bearing witness to all these atrocities that we see currently. And it has somehow a curative effect on the viewer as well as perhaps on yourself mm-hmm. when you do it. Can you speak a little bit about that?
Well, we were talking yesterday and I was telling you how affected I was and impacted I was as a teenager by the images that were broadcast from Saigon of the monks who mm-hmm. Set themselves on fire mm-hmm. to bring attention to the atrocities and the genocide of that war and what was happening to their land, and at that point they felt that that was how to go about that. And as a kid, I kept kind of going over that in my mind, trying to understand how somebody could come to a place where they would set themselves on fire as an act of peaceful demonstration and to wake people up. And we were talking about the work of Thich Nhat Hanh and socially engaged Buddhism and the forest monks in Vietnam who would travel to the villages where these atrocities were happening, both by the Americans and also by the North Vietnamese. And they would stand in meditation and watch, bear witness. And I began to really think about that as a meaningful expression and a way to approach these events that at times seem so overwhelming, and it seems like, well, what can one person do? It almost is like standing in front of a tsunami. And so people feel hopeless and people feel lost and people feel overwhelmed. And so part of it in my work is this attempt to bear witness. And of course, I've also noticed as a healer that many times people in their grief and their pain, their suffering, their loss, the stories of their life that are often contain all kinds of brutality and hardship. What is needed as a healing remedy is for someone to bear witness to it, someone to see it, to acknowledge it, not to fix it or to tell them what to do or to create a corrective prescription or you should have done this or that or whatever. Like, it just to bear witness. And I don't know how many people over the years would say to me something to the effect of just to be seen, to have someone really see what I am experiencing or what I went through or mm-hmm. to hear what my story is. Mm-hmm. Is restorative. And so for me over the years, you know, it was demonstrated to me time and time again that this modality of bearing witness, of not flinching, but of looking and seeing the world as it is, not in some kind of imaginary way or trying to tell people how to live or what to do or what they should do about this or that or whatever. I don't know. Mm-hmm. I don't know. But I think this idea of being awake mm-hmm. and being present mm-hmm. and being mindful is a medicine unto itself.
So then how does the work in your community, can you describe the work you're doing in your community and how it might relate to your art? Because I heard from the curator, from Haywan, that you're prolific, like you're constantly working on paintings. Like, you described in your home in California a community that you have. How does that work? How do people find you? How many of you are there? What do you guys do when you're... I don't know.
Well, you know, many, many years ago, my teacher said to me, he wanted me to go back to the United States and start working. In other words, in these traditions, he wanted me to start teaching people these traditions and these technologies. He said, well, you'd be better suited to it because you're from there, you speak the language, you understand their lives, you're able to communicate better you than me.
You're a bridge.
And so I was like, I don't want to. I have no interest in that. I have other things that I'm interested in doing. I have no interest in going back to the United States and being a healer. And he was insistent. And so in my mind, you know, I don't want to argue with the guy. He's my friend, he's my mentor, he's my teacher, we've spent a lot of time together, he's invested a lot of energy into me, let's say.
Right, and where is he from? Is he the Peruvian?
He's from Peru.
Yeah.
And the ghettos of Peru. Yeah,
okay.
He lived in a house made of cardboard and tin in the slums in Peru. And so I don't want to argue with him. So I say, okay. And I'm thinking to myself, well, I'll leave here. He'll never know. When I get back to the United States, he's not going to know what I do.
Yeah.
So I go back to the United States and somebody calls me up and says, you mind if I stop by and chat with you a bit? I said, no, fine, go ahead, you know. So guy comes over and we're sitting at the kitchen table and he's talking to me about, I don't know, some situation, some problem that he's got going on, whatever, and we're just talking and get done with the conversation. And he goes, you know, this has been extremely helpful. Could we do this again sometime? I'm like, sure, no problem. You know, not thinking really about anything. And literally, I kid you not, within the space of about 3 months, my kitchen is full and people are sitting in the living room waiting to talk to me. And back then we used to do this just sitting around the kitchen table until Dee was like, this is crazy. This is like the house is inundated with people. And it wasn't, you know, people could only know me through, you had to know somebody who knew me. It wasn't like,
you just showed up at the door, right?
No, people, you know, like, you knew somebody who was close to me. And and so that's how it began. And we just started working with people. And you know, I think of myself oftentimes more as a healer, teacher than a healer shaman, you know. I help people sometimes just see their life through the lens of a different culture, like a different way of looking, examining, understanding what's happening to you. And that perspective and shift of perspective is often enough to get people kind of out of some loop that they're caught in. To all of a sudden see their life, their journey, their experiences, their challenges from some other point of view. And so, you know, we started well over, you know, 30-some years ago, 35 years ago now, something like that. And always it's like family. It's like extended family. It's like someone says, you know, my sister, my brother, my child, my father, my mother, my aunt, my uncle. They're having a hard time. Can I bring them by? And so we're like, yeah, sure, you know, whatever.
So you don't work remotely. It's you kind of have to be in person, one-on-one.
Yeah, well, I'm old school. And that, I mean, during COVID, I especially in the early part of COVID, I talked to a lot of people on the telephone, not the computer, but the telephone, because I felt it was important that people were isolated and people felt alone and people were scared and you know, it was, nobody knew what was happening. So I said, you know what, I don't normally do this, but I said, well, I'm going to start just calling people, mm-hmm, just mm-hmm. checking in with mm-hmm, them, mm-hmm. let them yeah. know that we're all still connected yeah. and we're all okay, and you know, just and so I did that for, you know, maybe a year and a yeah. half or mm-hmm. 2 years, you mm-hmm. know, and then when the vaccines and, you know, started happening, whatever, mm-hmm. we slowly transitioned back. People
yes.
come from all over the United States and other parts of the world, and they'll come and, you know, stay with us for a little bit and do some work, and then they move on to wherever they're going.
Yeah.
I have people that have, you know, been my students for, you know, 25, 30 years, and, you know, they right. come and they go, and yeah. there's something they need to see or do, or a piece of work that yeah. we need to do together, and mm-hmm. then they take it and they go along when they go back to their life.
Yeah.
So that's how we do it.
Well, that's good to know.
Yeah.
And I'll see if I have someone to send to you. I just don't know how I would broach the topic, but I will ask you that later offline.
Yeah. Yeah.
So the current exhibition at SUNY, the Amelia Wallace Gallery, it runs until October 21, and it's titled Howls That Wake Us in the Night.
Yes.
What does that title mean, or where did it come from?
Well, it's a little bit of an inside joke, mm-hmm. because I've lived with wolves for, you know, over 30 years. So living with wolves is a, you know, you have to be certifiably insane but it's an experience like no other, because it's kind of this interspecies exchange with an animal that's not domesticated nor is interested in being domesticated. So it's a relationship that unfolds in mutuality and mutual respect for mm-hmm. each other's way of life.
Mm-hmm.
So people come to the house and they stay with us, and the joke at the breakfast table is when somebody spent the night at the house, we say to them, did the howling wake you up?
Oh, wow.
Because, of course, most people haven't slept in a place where they can hear the sound of wolves howling in
yeah,
the night.
Yeah.
And so when we were thinking of a title to the show, I was thinking a lot about that thing of being awake, of being mindful, of bearing witness, of this wakefulness.
Yes.
And
yes.
this kind of breakfast table joke
yes.
arose about the howls that wake you in the night.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And so it has a few different meanings on that level.
Well, that's good to know. I mean, yeah. I'm glad I asked.
Yeah.
I had a question here related to the COVID diary paintings, but I don't know. I think I'm going to go more personal. The crippled man's path is lit by flickering light of faith.
Mm-hmm.
That's one of the paintings, right? I think
yeah.
it's a longer title, Untitled
yeah.
with Walking in the Valley of Shadows 2021.
Yeah.
So what happened at that time during COVID with your leg that was broken or something?
Well,
like
yeah, I had just recently gotten back from China,
mm-hmm.
and I had been training extensively in this martial art tradition that is part of my life, and
mm-hmm.
and I had injured my leg severely in the training in China. So I came back and I needed to have a reconstructive knee surgery. And so I was on crutches and a little bit kind of disabled, you know,
mm-hmm.
in terms of getting around. And I didn't want to move and was unable to move around like big panels or something like that in my
mm-hmm.
studio, which
mm-hmm.
would normally be my thing.
Which explains the smaller works.
Yeah. And so I was kind of... So there I am, I'm on crutches,
mm-hmm.
I can't really move the paintings around
mm-hmm.
in my studio to work on them, because I put them up on the wall, I put them on
mm-hmm.
the floor,
mm-hmm.
I mean, I'm lifting them, whatever,
mm-hmm.
it's a very physical
mm-hmm.
process, plus the process of working on those big panels
mm-hmm.
is quite physical.
Mm-hmm.
So I see this pile of paper in the corner of my eye, and I go and I examine it, it's a stack of watercolor paper, and I say, ah. It's a perfect size. I can just sit here. There's nothing to move. There's
mm-hmm.
nothing to lift. The scale of the work is such that it's like something that's not like a monumental physical exertion to
mm-hmm.
do.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm compromised. I'm physically compromised and unable to get around. And that's when the COVID thing was happening in the beginning, you know, the shutdown and people staying home and like the whole world kind of shut down for a period of time.
Which ironically came out of China as well too.
And I had just been there when it happened.
Wow.
And so I'm kind of on crutches and quite limited, and I'm used to being physically very active.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And so I felt very compromised, and then the COVID thing is happening. And that's when I thought, oh, you know what, I'll take this opportunity, thinking, oh, it's going to be like a few months, it's going to come and go in a few months. And I'm going to just like make a few paintings during this time and be like a diary of COVID.
Right.
I didn't know it was going to last, you know, 3 years and kind of have such profound
impact
and consequences in the world. And so the crippled man was kind of, it was me, but it was also this idea of like it represented something about us, that we were the crippled man. And that, and the COVID exposed us to ourselves and our crippledness.
Mm-hmm.
And so the crippled man goes through the whole COVID diary, right? You keep finding him appearing, this lame person trying to make their way on a crutch and without a leg and this kind of thing. And,
I had a vision of Frida Kahlo, actually, as you described that. It's almost a similar type of work she's doing in the convalescence. But sorry, carry on.
Yeah, so for me, the crippled man became kind of the archetype that traveled through COVID. And even after my leg recuperated and I was fine and whatever, COVID was still happening. And so what I thought was going to be like a three-month painting project turned into 3 years and 35 paintings.
Amazing. But you don't seem to have any injury left from that. You healed very well.
Yeah, well, I'm fortunate in that way that the Holy Spirit, you know, watches out for me and keeps me capable. Yeah.
Amazing. Yeah, I think that's a good point about the energy of healing. There's two other questions I wanted to ask.
I
didn't write down one about the Buddha paintings, but since we talked about the series of COVID, maybe you can tell me about the Buddha paintings as well, because you said something interesting about this imagery from the various, not necessarily religions, but spiritual cultures are open to all of us, not just Buddhism or whatever. Can you talk a little bit about that?
I have this feeling, you know, and this extends to other things as well, is that the history, for example, of Christianity is they took the archetype of the Christ,
mm-hmm.
who was an embodiment of life born again, of forgiveness, teachings of kindness, of love, and they kind of like took out a patent on it. Like, he belongs to us. And if you want to worship him or have Christ in your life, you have to join our franchise.
Yes.
And I remember many years ago I was with an old healer and he had a cross on his neck. And I asked him about the cross because he was an indigenous person.
Mm-hmm.
And for him, of course, the energy of Christ and whatever was similar to other energetics that he knew.
Mm-hmm.
And so the spirit of Christ belonged to him as well.
So funny you said that, but go ahead. I'll tell you why after.
Mm-hmm. And so for me, I am interested in kind of taking back these archetypes that belong to our common collective unconscious. And so for me, the Buddha,
mm-hmm.
and this kind of archetype of this figure that is awake and compassionate and peaceful and sitting with equanimity and mm-hmm. wisdom mm-hmm. belongs to all of us. And I didn't feel that it was like you had to be a Buddhist to have access to it.
Right.
Like you don't have to be a Christian to have access to the teachings of Christ. And so...
Or a Muslim to have access to the teachings of Muhammad, right?
Right. And mm-hmm. so I really felt that the Buddha was not a representation of some kind of religious outlook. It was part of this great collective unconscious, and that imagery of the Buddha, just like the image of Christ on the cross, has appeared in many, many cultures and many, many different kind of renderings in mm-hmm. many different ways, because like we started in the beginning of our talk, all of these people went to the same well.
Right.
They all gathered water from the same well. Yeah. They just were at the water hole at different times.
Mm-hmm.
But it was the same water.
Well, that's what was so weird for me when I was in Gabon, and I mentioned that I was in this little village where they do the ceremonial practices, and in their temple, they also have images of Christ. And I just thought it was some remnant of the colonial past, but you just added another element to it, which I didn't think about at the time.
Yeah, and so, you know, these energies, right? It's like the energy of... in shamanism, you know, the energy of the mountain or the river or the wind or the storm. It's like you don't have to have some kind of particular belief to be out in a storm and hear the thunder and feel some kind of shaking inside of yourself. Like there's some kind of power out there, and you don't have to articulate it or name it or have some kind of theory about it. It's just primordial. And I believe that these other things, you know, like that embodiment of the Buddha or the Christ or other kinds of iconic mm-hmm. figures that have appeared, they hold these archetypal forces. And all people recognize it. So I'm always interested, like, why did Buddhism spread from some small village in India across the world?
Right.
If not right. for the fact that somehow people from all different cultures and all different ethnicities and all different ways of life recognize something that almost kind of resonates inside their deepest DNA.
Amazing. Yeah. I mean, a really beautiful thing, which whenever people... I mean, when you spoke earlier, because you were saying that now we started separating ourselves from objects and stuff and looking at things as... inanimate objects. In that sense too, when you think of all the injustices that man is able to do to each other, they can only do that when those people are objectified and are not any longer living things, but just some non-entity, you
Absolutely.
Know?
And so that
every
spirit of otherness, of that ability to separate oneself from the rest of creation, it begins to become a foundational piece of how you wind up with these things that are like, you're almost like just your jaws open and you're like, how could people do this? It's like, where does that come from? And of course, it's in that. It's in that, you know, just essential splitting off. And then instead of seeing a person or something that is alive or something that has a voice or something that has a song or something that has wisdom or something mm-hmm. that has some kind of meaning in the world, it's just a thing, and you can abuse it, you can discard it, you can throw it away, and it's this is something that all of us are going to have to find some way to put down.
Well, on that point, I wanted to ask, the process when you begin a work of art, does it come from an idea, a vision, something you see in the newspaper, from a conversation, from other artworks that you look at? Where's your inspiration coming from for the work that you do?
Well,
dreams, visions?
You know, a lot of people think because of who I am and kind of the trajectory of my life, whatever, is that the paintings arise out of some kind of visionary state, mm-hmm. you know, and some of them do, but I've been painting for 50 years, and Sometimes I feel inspired, and sometimes I don't feel inspired, and sometimes I feel like working, and sometimes I don't feel like working. And I've learned to treat painting as it's a practice. And so I go into the studio often with no idea. And if one looks at my work and examines it, you'll see often the record of many, many, many kind of attempts or directions to the visions and the imagery in my work is discovered. The process of painting is what I immerse myself in. And a painting can arise out of a drip, a splotch, some kind of place where I went to erase something and I saw something else. It could, some paintings have arisen from, you know, looking at the pattern on a plywood sheet, you know, that before I even put the gesso on it.
Mm-hmm,
and
mm-hmm.
Some of it does arise out of my experiences or my imprinting of, you know, just moving through the culture and seeing imagery
mm-hmm.
That is transmitted into me.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Some of it is just, you know, comes to me in the night and in some moments. Some of it is brought to me by messengers who leave the you know, the instructions.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And so as an artist who's made a life of making art, you know, now for 5 decades or more, I take it's like wherever it comes from, I'm okay with it.
Right, right.
I don't have any hierarchy of like, oh, this came to me in a vision, so
Yeah.
And even if the piece comes like in a form of a visionary presentation,
mm-hmm.
as soon as I start painting, of course, the process of painting takes over. And I lend myself to whatever is dictated by the flow of the materials mm-hmm. and the mediums and my reactions and relationship to the colors and the forms that are arising.
Mm-hmm.
And so even if a piece starts from kind of like a visionary blueprint,
mm-hmm.
it could very well not wind up there. I am not in any way obligated to that.
Yeah. No, I understand that.
Yeah.
Well, you mentioned how something about discovered. How did Haywan discover you?
It was through a friend, a woman, Florence Lynch, who was working with me some years ago.
Oh,
and,
wow, yeah.
And
I
then,
mean Florence.
And then she, Haywan was interested in doing, and this was at the beginning of COVID.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And she was, she found out that I was working on a project called the COVID Diaries.
Right.
So she was interested in interviewing me for some, I don't know, some
article or something.
Some article, some online periodical.
Mm-hmm.
So Florence arranged that, and Haywan called me from Korea
mm-hmm.
and was like, well, I want to interview you about the COVID Diaries. So we began to have this discussion about the COVID Diaries,
mm-hmm.
and that then she's like curious, like, well, who is this person? And well, he's working on the COVID Diaries, but then you start digging into the archives of my thing. It's like this enormous
mm-hmm,
archive,
mm-hmm.
and then it's like, well, oh. So that is what began our relationship.
Wow.
And she began to become very interested in
the idea of an exhibition.
Yeah, and so that's kind of where it was born. It was born in the middle of COVID.
Amazing,
yeah.
Amazing.
Yeah.
Are you still working with Florence Lynch?
No.
So are you interested in other gallery representation at this stage in your life? I mean, what
yeah,
are your feelings
so,
on that?
Well, right now what I'm interested in is because of the nature of my career, because of the nature of my life, because I've spent so much time kind of like out of the art world,
mm-hmm.
you know, like
mm-hmm.
my pursuits and my life has led me into other kinds of corners of the world,
mm-hmm.
so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
And though through it all, of course, I've produced this huge body of work throughout my entire life. I now, at this point in my life, I am interested in having my work be made available to the public, because I feel that it is, it has something to offer in terms of a stimulation or a dialogue or a conversation or something that feels important to me. And so I'm very, very interested in helping to nurture the relationships that will lead to the fact that the work will be more available to the public and more in the public's eyes, so that we could all be involved in these kinds of conversations.
Absolutely. And I think yesterday you mentioned, which I can imagine was true, back in the day when you were doing this stuff, people just didn't get it. They had no idea, like, what is he painting? Why is he painting this stuff? But it's so relevant today, even the work that was done back then.
Yeah.
I mean, so I think you're right. So everything comes in its time, you know. We can't really rush it. So let's see how it goes. So I don't know. Is there anything else I didn't ask you that you might want to share with the audience? I don't know if there's something.
No, I just, I appreciate you taking the time to have a conversation with me. And
It was a lot of fun.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
Well, let's do it again sometime.
Hopefully I will come out to California and we can have a different conversation.
Okay.
Thank you so much, Kenny.
Yeah, you're welcome. Thank you.
Bye. Welcome to the fall season of the Bees and Honey podcast. Today we're speaking with Kenny Felsott, who is an amazing artist based on the West Coast of the United States. And I was very blessed to speak to him recently about his body of work that spans many, many years. This current exhibition at the Amelia Wallace Gallery at SUNY Old Westbury has a sampling of these works, and it's up until October 21. So hopefully you get there to see what this work is all about. But please enjoy this podcast as much as I enjoyed doing it. You know, when I have interviews like the one with Kenny Felsott, I'm really, really, really reminded of why I started this podcast and how important it's been to me personally to interact with some of the people that you've heard on the podcast. Kenny is an amazing artist. I hope you get to see the show. It's up, as I said, SUNY Old Westbury at the Amelia Wallace Gallery, and it runs until October 21. It's a bit of a trek if you live in New York, but it's well worth it. Have a great day and see you again on the Bees and Honey podcast.